Welcome. We're going to go ahead and get started. I'm Jennifer Adams. I'm the CEO and the founder of Jennifer Adams Brands, an international home furnishings company, and I'm your MC for today. I'm thrilled to be a partner with Watermark Conference for Women because I get my biggest joy from helping women aspire to be their most full potential in life, and that is everything that Watermark is about. Like many of you, I came from very humble beginnings. In fact, I used to clean houses to earn money. I was cleaning people's toilets and making their beds long before I launched my first home product company in bedding. In fact, I spent most of my life and most of my career without any more education beyond a high school degree until my recent graduation from Harvard Business School under OPM, or Owners, Presidents, and Management Program. Thank you. And I'm actually here representing Harvard Business School today, so I'm so excited about it. But I truly understand your struggles and your triumphs. And I embrace and support your journey as women leaders. And I am so proud of you for having the courage to invest in yourself and show up here today, where you're going to gain invaluable tools that are really going to lift you to your most full potential. Thank you so much for joining this breakout session on burnout recovery. We're going to show you how to end your exhaustion and reignite your spark. If there's one thing I hope you take away from today, is that no matter where you are right now and what you're feeling, if you're exhausted, it happens to the best of us. We all experience it, and it's typically in the least opportune moment. It does not mean you're a failure. It does not mean you're not cut out to do what you're doing. And it doesn't mean you're not on your way to doing huge, phenomenal things. Now, we are going to be led by Leah Weiss. She is an extraordinary human being. She is a teacher at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, where she created a program on mindful and compassionate leadership. And her program was concepted by the Dalai Lama himself. Now, Leah is a world-renowned researcher, lecturer, and author, and an everyday regular girl, just like us, with hopes, dreams, and challenges. She's going to lead you through an action-packed 45 minutes with an extraordinary panel. So please bring your hands together and help me in welcoming Leah Weiss to the stage. Thank you.
Is this on? We're good?
Yes,
for this?
Good.
Awesome. Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. I'm really excited for the conversation we're going to have today. I think this is a crucial topic. And the way we're going to structure our time, first, I want to just briefly introduce my wonderful colleagues and panelists. And then I'm going to frame the topic. And then we're going to open it up and have a conversation, and then open it up to have a broader conversation with all of you. So please do be thinking along the way about what questions you want to bring forward. First I'd like to introduce Kristen Wong, who is an accomplished author, has a fantastic podcast on this topic called, you'll love the title, I love the title, The Recovering Workaholic. Fabulous, right? Who doesn't need that in this room? And I'm going to ask each of them, when they answer the first question I'll pose, for them to say more about their background to kind of give more color. So I'm going to give the succinct version. Yuna Kim, founder and CEO of Simple Habit, who has created an incredible business out of supporting people through mindfulness in accessible ways in warding off and recovering from burnout is one of the key applications, and we're going to hear more about that. And Allie Stripling, I'm delighted that you flew quite far from across the ocean to join us, and I think it's going to be really wonderful to hear about your experience with struggling with, recovering from burnout. And she's a senior manager on community and inclusion at ARM, so has a very practical as well as personal perspective to share with us. So these are my co-pilots. To frame the topic, I want to just share a little bit of some high-level interesting research. So starting from the perspective of gender and burnout, because here we are at a conference looking largely at gender as it intersects with important issues. So one really interesting thing stands out to me that I want to put for your consideration and for you to mull over. Men, as they age, the rates of burnout go down. Women, as we age, the rates of burnout go up. Interesting, right? I think not unrelated to some of the other dynamics that we have statistics around, like if you look at informal caregiving, meaning taking care of a sick relative, that work is 75% implemented by women. So just putting together some of the cross-functional roles that people have. So I think it becomes an important part of the discussion. And to me, this question of burnout is one that we want to frame from a perspective. I always like to go in saying, let's understand it. Let's recognize what the signs are, right? It could be someone disengaging, but it also could be becoming cynical, right? Because if you think about the example of when you are struggling to sustain empathy because the demands on your time and your person are so overwhelming, what is the impact that we have on us? And I think one of the useful ways to think about this is the neuroscience of how our tipping points function if you look at our brains. Empathy for other people, for example, one of the things that runs out when we are suffering from burnout, is not a renewable resource in the sense that we get depleted. We have a certain amount that we allocate and it gets used up. Now, this isn't the whole story, luckily, or this would be a pretty depressing panel and you should probably scoot. The research that I think is crucial for us to keep in mind is that compassion is a renewable resource. Compassion meaning engaging with other people's suffering, but from a perspective of healthy boundaries, from understanding support and connectivity, but not, remember back to Psych 101 when you were first introduced to the idea of empathy and mirror neurons. Remember those mother-infant studies that you probably heard about where the baby mimics the facial expressions of the mother? So that think of that as a shortcut for empathy. If we're literally feeling with all the struggle of everybody around us, that does become untenable over time, right? Combined with scarcity of time, and in many of our work roles, we are doing more than one person's full-time job. Consolidating of roles puts us at 1.5 to 2 times what any one person's workload could and should be. So we're living in a time where conditions are challenging. So I would say one of the things that's really useful is for us to understand what does burnout look like in us so that we can catch it early, and engage with some of the things that, and this is what we're going to largely talk about. What do you do when you realize you're starting to struggle with burnout? Or what do you do when your colleagues or coworkers or the person you report to are struggling with it and it's impacting everything about how they treat you? Or your relatives and loved ones, right? These are all very real questions, especially if we consider the fact that if you look at the research, women are more likely to do the emotional carrying and supporting. So I think it behooves us to understand, resource ourselves, and pay attention to not just what we are accomplishing in terms of checking tasks off, but to the how of our work, so that we can really put purpose front and center, we can understand how to set up our days and structure our time in the positions of not just our own work, but the people around us. So this is just to frame some of the conversation I want to have with you all in this session. And I think what I'd like to do next is just start by engaging our panelists. So, Kristen, I'd love if you would start us off. You've done a tremendous amount of research about burnout. What would you add to how you would frame both the challenge, the role of gender, but also what we can do so that we don't leave everybody here really depressed right before lunch?
As you were talking, I was thinking about Brené Brown's keynote this morning about having a partner who is really supportive of all the things that you were saying, because a lot of these responsibilities do fall on women. I mean, and there's research that backs this up. I think UNICEF did this major study not too long ago that found women still do more of the household work, and they're working in, you know, their actual jobs. So I think having a partner that is receptive to the consequences of that is really important. So picking that partner in the first place, and then just talking to, you know, your spouse about it, and how they can kind of get on board with it. I actually went to marriage counseling with my husband before we got married to kind of talk through these things, and it was really helpful to, you know, just have a way of a shortcut for communicating to him what I need from him, how, when I feel stressed out, when it's getting a bit much for me. Because, you know, like Brené Brown said, when her husband was like, we never have any ham in this house, and she flipped out. That's completely something that I would do, because I have those, you know, triggers when I'm burnt out. So just having somebody that, you know, is an ally to you, I think is really important. And acknowledging it yourself, because I think a lot of times, you know, what I do, and I think a lot of women do, is we just say, like, we just deal with it, right? Like, we're stressed out, and we're like, oh, but that's just, we get so used to being stressed out that we don't even question when it's too much. So I think just acknowledging that it happens in the first place, acknowledging that there might be a disparity between men and how men and women experience stress is important, and just paying attention, being aware of the added stressors in your life, and not just saying, like, oh, it's, I get 5 hours of sleep every night. That's normal. That's just my life, you know. Figuring out a way to make that not normal, I think, is important.
It's critical. And what would you say for people who want to, how do you recognize signs of burnout in coworkers and family? What would some of the signposts be that you'd point to?
I think sleeplessness is a big one. Like, if you're getting 6 hours of sleep every night, there's a good chance you're probably burnt out. And there was some study that came out not too long ago that found, you know, when you're getting 6 hours of sleep over time, and that's all you're getting, like, that is the equivalent of driving when you're inebriated. So it's just kind of has the same effect. But in the short term, I think, like, you know, if you're cynical, like you said, if you find yourself irritable, you know, I don't have kids, but I have, you know, pets, and I find myself just really annoyed by everything they do when I'm burnt out versus when I'm, you know, on vacation. When I'm on vacation, I'm like this totally chill person that's just, you know, so relaxed and so easygoing, and then I become this just scary human when I'm burnt out, and just noticing how my tone changes. And I've even asked my husband to, like, because he says sometimes, like, oh, your voice, like, changes when you're stressed. I can hear it in you, and I don't even notice it because, again, I'm so used to just being stressed. I'm like, this is just life, right? Everybody feels this way. So I've said to him, can you point out when you notice that my tone gets a little bit intense? You know, cynicism, sleeplessness, insomnia, when you're saying yes to everything too much, I think. If there's something, and probably everybody in this room can think about this right now, there's probably something that you know that you should be saying no to right now. Overcommitting, your schedule's too full. I don't know, those are some of the signs, I think.
Yeah, great, those are very helpful. I think the identification, so you can catch things early. Another one I may add to the list, alongside what you said, is when the self-care activities start to lapse, right? That can be a really, when for yourself or for the coworker who always put on their sneakers and went and worked out or went for a walk at lunchtime, they stopped doing that. That can be a sign. And it's one of these paradoxical things that when we need it the most can be the time we're least likely to invest. So having that in our awareness, I think, is critical. So Yuna, talk to us about how meditation, you would propose that people bring that in, particularly if it's a new strategy for people in the room and you've read some of the science of why it would be helpful, and we all know it's good for stress reduction. What should we do to get started? Mm-hmm. And how does your work in this space intersect with the topic of burnout?
Cool. Sure. And I also maybe share the context of how I got to burnout, which
please
got me to start the company. So I started my career in investment banking, and I was very used to working like 900 hours a week. And then I decided to start a company. I was like 23 at that time. This was a different company. And this company, I lived with my coworkers. We were like six people out of a two-bedroom apartment in Manhattan. And we worked like crazy for 3 years. And one day, just I couldn't get out of bed. I wasn't sure, like, what am I doing? Like, why does this matter? And that's when I realized I burnt out. Or people talk about burnout all the time, but I didn't know until I experienced it that it was a burnout. So I remember going down to LA, turned off my phone, and it was for like 2 days, like didn't check my email. That was like the first time in my life that I've ever done that. And then I started doing all these, just exploring different things to get out of burnout, which included therapy. I went to Whole Foods all the time, bought anything that like promised stress relief or or calmness, I would just try them on. And then somebody recommended me meditation, and that has had a crazy amount of impact in my life. It has changed the way I respond to stress. Like, I still get stressed all the time, but the way I respond to it has changed. Before, I used to react to stress. But now I would be more aware of, am I stressed? And then I would come up with strategies to how to change that. So I got into meditation, and after that company, I went to Stanford Business School, and that's when I started working on this idea of, you know, we need a very simple daily stress app that would give you 5-minute meditation around your. Is this okay?
No, it's not your. I was just making sure the sound. Okay, cool. There's some humming. Sorry to distract
no worries. You. That's when I realized that we need a daily stress app that would offer us 5-minute meditation from world's best experts around the world, not just one person or not one meditation teacher. And also, I realized that I was meditating to very different situations in life. So, you know, I would meditate before a difficult conversation. I used to go into the bathroom and meditate for 5 minutes and come out. Or I would do it after, or like even before a public speaking like this, or going to sleep is another problem. So we wanted to make sure that meditations are designed for very specific contexts and also very simple and easy to do. So that's what Simple Habit is. And one of the things I've learned about self-care is, so if you're trying to meditate, one of the best way to start meditating is start small. So don't try to do 30-minute meditation starting tomorrow, because most likely that's not going to pan out. But if you start with 5 minutes, that's so much easier to squeeze in your day. Another thing that we're seeing in our users is people that are able to create a habit easily, it's usually if you meditate right after you wake up or like right before going to bed. And the reason is you anchor it to an activity that you do all the time, so that, you know, when you wake up and you just meditate right away instead of checking your phone to check your emails, then you get distracted, right? Mm-hmm. If you also create a habit of being just more mindful of how you're feeling and meditating to those emotions, that's another way to do it. For example, like yesterday I had like 8 back-to-back meetings and I was feeling like all over the place, so I went to go meditate. So things like that.
Thank you. Yeah, it's such an intriguing, you know, the early research in mindfulness was pretty much all around 45 minute a day meditation, which was, it's a tall ask, right? Like who in here has an extra 45 minutes in your day that you're looking to allocate? Raise your hand. Like nobody, right? And I think this has become a really important, and for me too, you know, my path to meditation, I spent my 20s doing 100-day and 6-month meditation retreats, and then I went on to have 3 kids, so I don't go away for 100 days. I'm lucky if I have like 100 seconds when I'm at home during waking hours. So I think this really is the intersection of how do we take these skills, both of mindfulness, but even positive psychology more broadly, to make it a minimum viable, like what's the thing that will have impact but be the smallest, most relatable, so that you can actually like use the habit change research, which is consistent exactly with what you're saying of pick something you're going to succeed at, start small, build off of it, right? But the challenge is finding what does that look like in each of our lives, I think becomes a critical, just like we all know we should exercise, we all know we should eat healthy, but everybody in this room is going to approach that differently, and we need to, because if you try the strategy that's working for your neighbor, that's not likely to just transplant. It will have organ rejection. So I love where you're going with this, of like specific, context-focused, and the emotion regulation piece, or working with emotions. And I think for many people, we're now bringing up our children. Like my 8, 5, and 4-year-old are learning skills of mindfulness and emotional intelligence from the time they can talk. Unfortunately, for many of us who are a little older than that, we didn't grow up with the same kind of awareness of what's the damage of suppression. Right, there's physical damage. There's amazing research happening at Stanford around like what happens to not just the mental stress that the effort of suppressing emotions causes, but the physiological impact, right? So this, we're in a really interesting moment with research, but also like how do you learn this stuff as an adult? Or for many people, the challenge would be, I know this in my personal life, but I'm not quite sure what that looks like professionally. And so that can cause a kind of dissonance of what does it mean to be authentic and candid and, and relate with people in a way that's not a different version of oneself than we have at home when we get to work. And I think that kind of dissonance is something that contributes to burnout for many people, these different identities we're trying to hold up together. And I think that there's a beautiful model that's happening in the conversations we're having today. I mean, someone like Gloria Steinem is a pretty great representation of just being a full self right there, right? Boom, like Brené Brown, boom. So what does that look like? I think taking that up as a challenge for us, how do we bring that in? In my mind, it has everything to do with the burnout. One other piece I wanna add just from the research that I think is useful to keep in mind, we're mostly talking about personal factors. But if you talk to the researchers who study burnout, one of the metaphors that rose to the surface in my mind that I want to share with you, you can't look at a cucumber in a pickle barrel and ask it why on earth it's becoming a pickle. You have to understand the context and the implication it has for the cucumber. We are the cucumbers, people, right? And so being aware of the impact of our environment, our culture, our workplaces, and what we can do to support resilience versus a burnout tendency, not just in ourselves, but in people around us. And I think the smart organizations are taking this not just as a pointing fingers at the individuals who are burnt out, but as a systemic question. Right, healthcare is off the charts right now. We have rates of physician burnout that are well over 50%. They're translating to substance abuse and suicide and major issues, not just impacting the physicians, but all of us. Over 1 million Americans have a provider, right, we are touched by this impact as well. So I think the question of culture and system needs to come into conversation with what we're talking about, because my guess is when we get into the discussion section of this, many of the challenges that are going to come forward have to do with what do I do when I'm in a workplace that will never allow me to turn off. Right, there's lawsuits about this right now. There's one in the news from a former employee suing Yelp for being asked to be always on call around the clock. Should we expect that? Can we expect that? What will we do instead of that? So I will interrupt myself here, and I think it's actually a great segue to hear from you, Allie, about your experience personally and also how you see this in your role within your organization.
Great. I've got quite a different perspective from those on the panel in terms of that my burnout happened in October of last year. So I had a great opportunity. I absolutely loved my job at Arm, and a colleague left, and I got the opportunity to take on their responsibilities. You know, like it happened on Friday, and I got her role on Monday in addition to my day role. And that's quite common, that happens. And I was so super excited about it. I was just like really delighted. And thought, you know, I can really, you know, add value to diversity and inclusion at Arm, and it's something, an area that I was passionate about. I lasted about 6 weeks. My emails went through the roof. The expectation that I placed on myself was significant. I didn't want to fail. I had this incredible opportunity, and I'm a resilient, confident, ambitious woman, and I just didn't want to let anyone down. And for me, I didn't notice that I was burning out. I mean, I was just, you know, kind of living the dream, but doing that, you know, in the morning before work, during work, after work, thinking about work. I couldn't sleep. I started eating a lot. I started drinking after work. Not that I had a problem, but, you know, I suddenly thought, you know, this will take the edge off. I've had a really long day. I'll go to the pub. That's a British term, I think, but we'll have a couple of beers, and I'll feel great about it. And then one day, you know, I came into work. We have a shuttle bus. It was running late. Someone had put some boxes behind my desk. And I broke. I mean, I literally just broke. I mean, my poor line manager is here. And, you know, for the first time in my life, I was in absolute pieces. And I didn't see it coming. I didn't notice those signals in myself. But in hindsight now, looking back, I can see that I started scheduling my husband at the weekend. You know, I was super planning, making most of all the time that we had. I wasn't nice to one of my colleagues, which is really unlike me. It is. Some of my colleagues are in the room. I started getting that kind of, you know, I wasn't looking after myself at all. So mentally and physically, I was just getting to a point where I didn't love myself and I just couldn't cope with the work. And it resulted in me just breaking down. But the good news is that I was, you know, really well supported within my organization and from friends and family. And the first thing that I found is that we have to talk. Right? This is why I'm here, and I'm not a public speaker, you can probably tell. So I've got that kind of glorious air that I can tell you that I'm nervous because I don't speak, right? And what I found, actually, is that when I started speaking to people and saying, this is what's happened to me, I've got perimenopausal symptoms, which I'd never heard about. So I've got increased stress, increased emotions. I'm finding things challenging for the first time. I've had anxiety attacks. I mean, I've never been anxious in my life. And suddenly I was overwhelmed with trying to make a phone call to a colleague to talk about my new role and some of the projects that we were going to work on together. And I couldn't pick up the phone to speak to them. And but because of the support, because of the individuals that I was able to reach out to, I've been able to do a phase return back to the organization. I'm now back full time. I'm a little bit more carefree in my attitude. I've learned that whilst I was off, things didn't go, like, it wasn't terrible. You know, things didn't get done. But it was actually all right. So I'm learning more now that I have to have self-management. So when we do go on holiday, please don't add, you can still reach me on my mobile even though I'm on holiday. No, be on holiday. You know, if you don't want to answer emails of the evening and you want to spend it with your family, spend it with your family or go and do something else. You know, we have to take some control back of our lives because I love my job, right? I could do it 24/7, but I also love my life and I've got to give to that.
Yeah, that's a good... So I love where you're going with this too, of like the tactical, don't put the auto on your auto responder how to catch you and send you a text on your, or call you on your vacation. Yeah. What other tips, and I'd love to hear from each of you. You know, it's also helpful to hear about strategies you tried that didn't work, right? Because for many of us, it's trial and error, and a strategy that works for Ali might not translate to me. So I'd love to hear from each of our panelists, what's one strategy that you recommend, and what's one that you tried that makes sense but didn't quite fit as well for you?
So one of the things that I've started doing was focusing on nourishing my mind and my body. So I've given up alcohol. I'm 3 months without any alcohol, woohoo, or caffeine. Wow. I haven't actually managed to give up chocolate yet, but you know, that might be next. But I think probably really focusing on the fact that, you know, to maintain stress, because we're still always going to be busy at work, right, or busy in our lives, you have to eat well. And that means, like, you know, no silly fad diets for me anymore. It means thinking about what I'm going to have for breakfast, what I'm going to have for lunch, what am I going to have for dinner, and trying to break away from that being at my desk or in front of the TV, but thinking about, actually, I'm going to sit here, enjoy this. And journaling. Journaling has really helped me. So that kind of
what has been great about today, what have I found challenging about today, and what can I do different about that tomorrow?
What's something you tried on that didn't fit for you, that was advice people gave or a tip you'd read about or what all?
So when I first experienced the burnout and I was doing a phased return to work, so I was doing 3 days a week working and then I had the rest of the time to myself, I started focusing on exercise and I was like swimming and running and walking my dogs and like, yeah, I've got this, I'm going to be great. And then I suddenly realized I was doing exactly what I had been doing at work with my physical well-being. And so now I'm just doing nourishment of my mind and I'm walking my dogs and I haven't got a plan. So I'm not going, hey, I'm going to run on Wednesday. I'm going to swim on Thursday. Then I'm going to meet my friends and we're going to go out for like a massive walk with the dogs. And I'm just trying to be like, take it easy. So for me, what didn't work is like planning recovery like you plan work. It makes sense, right? You say it out loud.
Absolutely.
It's like, oh yeah, why would you do that?
It makes a lot of sense.
I guess my practical tip would be to learn to say no more often. That's the hands down the biggest thing that's helped me is just setting those boundaries and saying like, you know, I'm sorry, I don't have time in my schedule for this, and not being apologetic about it, and also understanding that people are going to be disappointed when you say no to them. So if somebody, you know, an editor asks me to do extra work or somebody wants to like pick my brain or something, you know, and it's hard sometimes to say no to those things because sometimes I like having my brain picked. Sometimes I want to, you know, talk to somebody and help them out however I can. But it's important to set those boundaries and saying no is a big part of that. And I think understanding that people are going to be disappointed. They're not going to be like, oh, good, you're saying no. Good for you. They're going to be like, oh, who do you think you are? You know, and becoming okay with that, I think, is important. The other thing, I think, is building buffers into your schedule. So not overcommitting. And when you plan something, when you schedule it into your schedule, you know, overestimate how much time it's going to take so that you're not underestimating and then you end up with less time in the week than you thought. So add buffers, actually schedule time into your schedule to do nothing. Otherwise, that gap will be filled with something else. So schedule an hour in your week of just nothing. You know, put it in your calendar. It sounds like really stupid, but it makes a big difference because if it's not there, you will fill it with something else. What's not helped me is exactly what you said, like trying too hard, trying to force it, and being really demanding on myself. Like, I had a friend who went to the doctor for an issue, and the doctor was like, you really need to focus on not being stressed out so much. And she was like, that's the most stressful thing ever. So, you know, there's so much pressure to be, like, efficient, to be the best version of yourself. I read so many self-improvement books, and at some point, it just gets so overwhelming, and I have to put it down and just focus on self-care. And I know self-care kind of, you know, has become this overused buzzword lately, but it's really important. It's just making sure you get enough sleep, making sure you're doing things that are good for yourself, just basic human needs, making sure those are covered. That's what helps, and not trying to like overdo it and be like this super efficient like robot person.
I think it's such an interesting point, the scheduling. It directly, I think, ties in. I was just calling a friend yesterday who's trying to decide about a job offer, and I was being her counterpoint to think through how she was going to handle it. And she, when we got on the phone, I said, how are you doing today? She said, I've literally not eaten or gone to the restroom since I started this morning. And, like, the point I want to make about this is not to shame her for over-jamming her day, but I think we can forget if we don't put in windows or we have magical thinking about if you have the back-to-back-to-back meetings and there's no space, how are the basic things going to happen? But not only are they going to happen for us as an individual, but when we are working with teammates, what are we doing to support them, right? And how are we setting the culture for people who report to us, asking them in our one-on-ones, this needs to be a part of the check-in culture at work. What are you doing to take care of yourself? You know, one of the best mentors that I've had in this area, when I would do my planning process for the next year, she would look at it and just point out the areas that she called were magical thinking. Like, there's literally no way you're going to accomplish this in this window of time. So let's just name that, understand that, and look for another approach. I think these are some of the very tactical, the translation of the magical thinking in time or trying to keep so many balls in the air, trying to do more roles than we have. I think it comes back to some communication skills as well as the scheduling that we need to be able to manage out and up so that we can not just carry on when we realize the deadline's never going to be met by ourselves, by our team. The last thing that's actually good for the organization is if we keep that to ourselves. So we need to have the skill set, but that requires, it feels risky, especially if you're not the manager of the whole area. And this is some of the very tactical trainings, I think, that we need to be looking at, not just early in career, because if you look at the research, like I said, women are getting more burned out later in the career. So what's happening that's along that curve? You know, what are your tips that you would share? And also, what are things that you tried that didn't work?
So number one is try meditation. Try small with 5-minute meditations. You can try out Simple Habit. It's on an iOS or Android app, and you can try out. But when you don't have that, for example, like just earlier in this panel, I felt like there were a lot of things going on in my head, because like even coming here on my Uber ride here, I was on a conference call. I know that going back up to the city, I'm going to be on another. I don't have the time for my one-on-ones with my direct reports. I'm doing that over the call. And so sometimes you only have like 30 seconds. And what I was doing earlier was just feeling your feet on the floor, looking at the colors around the room, and just appreciating that you can see the colors and like the smell that you can smell in this room, and hearing all the sound. So like little just awareness throughout the day really helps. So that's number one tip. Number two, it's something that I've started doing, which is I printed out my calendar. So every 3 weeks, I would print out my calendar in colors. And I would grab two highlighters, one's red, one's green. So green is anything that energizes me, I would like circle in green. Anything that drains me, I would circle them in red. And I would look at the proportion of green and red. So if you have more than 70, 80% of that being green, I think you're good. However, if it's less than that, then you need to do something about it. So I would look at the trend of like what, you know, any patterns that I'm seeing. So for me, I noticed that any meetings that are happening after 7 p.m. for me was in red. Any meetings also from like 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. was in red as well, because that's when I can think the most clearly and I want to do my own like emails or like thinking about strategies. So I started to shift around all my meetings that way. Also noticed that I had all my meetings were like 1 hour or 30 minutes. So then what happens is I'm always late to the next meeting and I'm like running. So I started making my meetings to either 25 minutes or 50 minutes so I can run to the bathroom in between. So strategies like that. And lastly, something I've so I'm all about self-improvement. Like we are, Simple Habit is a self-improvement platform, and you know, people that work at Simple Habit are very into self-improvement, and people that use it also are that way. So then one of the things that are like downside about that is that, for example, if you're on in this kind of conference where you're just learning a lot about these tips or experts that know much better than you do on certain things, sometimes in my mind I'm like, how come I didn't know that? Or like, how come I'm not as good as that person? And I noticed that gives me a lot of stress and anxiety, and I'm all, because I'm always looking to like grow. So one thing I've started doing, which is accepting the fact that I will be, you know, 8 or 9 out of 10 on a lot of areas, but I will give up on being 10 out of 10 for all of these areas. And that mindset has like really shifted like self-care, for example, because I'm in a meeting and somebody, you know, tells me something that makes me believe that I made a horrible mistake, then I would forgive myself because I am 8 or 9 out of 10 at that aspect. So that's helpful. What has not been helpful? I start earlier this year, I made a resolution that I'm going to run every morning. That didn't work out. So now I'm doing a 5-minute run So I have the luxury of like having a gym in my building. I live in the city. So what I do now is like even if I'm not gonna run for 10 minutes, I'm still gonna go check in for like 5 minutes, just to create that habit. So this morning I ran for like 3 minutes and I came back up. I think it took me more time to go to the gym than actually running. But yeah, so that's something that I'm doing. But yeah,
fantastic. Two thoughts to weave in, or one is pulling from some of the themes around self-compassion, and just want to tie in some of the, there's great research around the fact that A, we can develop self-compassion, so if that's a challenge, it doesn't have to stay a challenge. Understanding that self-criticism is, when we are self-critical, our brain and our body registers that the same way as if someone else was being externally critical. So it's really important to actually pay attention, as cheesy as it sounds, and I can't believe I'm like, this is the kind of stuff I never thought I'd be in talking to large room people, like pay attention to your self-talk, but like actually it's critical in understanding how we and people around us, we're in Silicon Valley, right? So we need to learn from failure. We're feedback cultures everywhere. Whether we are or we aren't, we better say we are. But all of these things can lead us down kind of cycles of rumination and self-criticism. How do we make sense of, what if we're not an 8 or 9 out of 10? What if there's things that like we're legit like a 1 or 2 out of? Can we still, how do we make sense of that? How do we make sense if we were the best in whatever category and eventually we level up in our education or in our work to be surrounded by people who are equally good or better? So we have to have some strategy there to understand that's how we're going to make sense of that, how we're going to handle it when we make mistakes, which we will make, so that we can really downregulate, unpack learnings. So that's one whole domain I want to suggest is really critical if you want to think about burnout, and is we can develop it. There's programs that have been researched of measures that you can train yourself to get better at it. So that's on offer. And then the other piece that also I think came up for the three of you that to me is mission critical is paying attention to purpose. So I love Una's ideas as well about like let's do forensics on our calendars. But also, let's pay attention to how we, the ways that we're spending our time. To use Barb Fredrickson, who is a pioneer in positive psychology, trained at Stanford, is written amazing books and done some of the most important research. She defines purpose as a far-reaching and steady goal, something personally meaningful and self-transcendent. That, if we feel that about even some subset, I would argue, I don't know that, I feel like I'm probably not at 70 or 80%, and I do a lot of work that I love, because there's just also a lot of stuff that has to happen. But if you look at the research of people like Dr. Amy Rusnetsky at the Yale School of Management, who researches purpose and teaches about it, if you even interject a little bit of extra role behavior, sort of academic speak for like stuff you like to do at work that might not be part of your core job description, if you can get yourself to sit in on that meeting or that project, maybe it's an hour or two or three a day, I mean not a day, a week, literally a week, making those small touch-ins with things that you're learning and developing go a really long way towards feeling a stronger sense of purpose, then building off of that to advocate for ourselves over time to be spending more and more of our day aligned with our purpose. And then, of course, we have to come back to the pickle barrel problem, which I hope we'll do in discussions around what do we do, you know, when we came into a line of work motivated by purpose and then find ourselves in an organizational context that doesn't fit. There's dissonance for us with our perspective on where we'd like to spend our time or organizational values or culture and what all. But paying attention, because if you look at the research on burnout, it's often about the culture. Problems with the administrative values or economic decision making, where finances are being spent or where our time is allocated, our frustration in response to those issues can become a major source of friction and burnout over time. So I want to encourage us to think about the different levels. Let's move on to some discussion and questions. We have microphones set up, and it's a great time for you to bring forward where are you with this topic of burnout, and how does it intersect with your work and your life and the people around you.
Thank you, Leah, so much, and thank you to all of the panelists. You're not off the hook yet. And the good thing is now we get the chance to put Leah on the hot seat. We can ask her questions, but you can also ask questions of anybody up here. But first, I have one to get you started, and it's going to go to Leah. As women, we all feel fear and guilt that if we take the time to take care of ourselves, possibly work out, take the time to actually eat lunch, or meditate, that we're going to be letting other people down and that something wrong could happen. How do we deal with that inevitable fear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is something I've been thinking a lot about. And honestly, I just gave a talk recently, which is the first time I've spoken about this publicly. Last year, I turned 40, and I am a behavior change expert, right? It's kind of at the core of everything I do. And over the last few babies and a lot of stressful work and a lot of travel, gained a bunch of weight in the last few years. So turned 40, said, this is not only my 40th birthday, 10th wedding anniversary, first book coming out, youngest child turning 3, so ostensibly he was supposed to sleep through the night. He doesn't, but that's what I was told. And fast forward a year later, and I'm in the doctor's office having gained 10 pounds and blood work coming back that I'm pre-diabetic. So I'm not saying this from a perspective of just like abstraction here. I think the problem often comes to putting together blind spots with choices, the micro choices we're making day in and day out. And I think that's been a lot of the examples we've been hearing from. So I want to suggest that one of the things that's been most helpful to me, and since the night of my birthday 2 months ago, I wrote a blog and like put it out to my newsletter list and a bunch of friends, accountability and community. I'm not saying you all have to go out and write like a public blog about the thing you're working on that's not going so well, but can you find a way to articulate it more directly to people who you spend your time with, coworkers, family members, right, who will both help you support yourself, because there's so much mitigating against us. You know, when I was kind of going through this process and thinking about what I know, behavior change research, and then reading the example of someone like Indra Nooyi, when she became CEO of Pepsi in 2001, she was called to get the job offer, goes home to tell her family, and this isn't to bag on her family, because I think this could happen in many homes. Her mom said, she was about to make the announcement, I got the job offer to be CEO of Pepsi. The mom said, hold up, I want to, she said, I have an announcement, we're out of milk. Can you please go get the milk? She said, but my husband's home, you've been here, go get the milk, the announcement can wait. So I think the point is we need support, because there's a lot of small messages coming against our putting the time and the choices towards our well-being. And when we don't have that, we have nothing. So I want to say the accountability piece and the support is huge in my mind, and has been a huge difference for me in the last, like, I didn't get any traction for a year and I've lost 20 pounds in 2 months. Yay. Long way to go, but like, you know, it's because I put out there, and as I'm making choices, I think about it. And that's why behavior change experts talk about your accountability buddy, right? Your community, having that touch point. It's why Weight Watchers works better than other options. But what are there's virtual accountability. There's in your life, in your workplace, in your family accountability. I also have a lot to say about ritual, but I'm not going to do that right now. You can read my next book, and we'll talk about that.
Thank you. And, you know, I'll say that I think knowing that we're normal when we have these feelings, and that the guilt is something, and the fear is that we all feel. It doesn't mean that you're not deserving of doing these tactics that the girls are all talking about. It's a real life thing. Okay, we have time for a few questions. So I'm gonna go, and thank you for lining up, I appreciate that. Can you please step up to the mic and tell us your name?
Hi, my name is, can you hear me? My name is Sabina.
Could you talk a little bit closer to the mic?
Sorry, can you hear me?
No, I can.
Hi, my name is Sabina.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you guys for this panel. I relate to a lot of it. And my question for you is balancing when you have ambitions to do things and realizing that it's not tenable. Like, I've been working over 40 hours a week for a long time. And so in theory, I can say, that's too much. I'm going to take a step back. But I have a lot of things that are now on my plate because I've taken them on my plate. And so how do you have those conversations to pull back but still keep moving forward in what you're doing in your career?
That's a great one. Leah, do you want to take that one or do you want to toss it to...
I was thinking, I'd love to hear from Ali and also
Wonderful.
Kristen, if you have some thoughts from your podcast. You
and great. Mark.
Great.
Yeah. I mean, I can relate to that situation. But I think one of the things that we need to be able to do is to understand... actually, how are you going to be the best you can be at the work that you're doing? Because if you want to progress, there's some things that you need to be able to achieve. And if you're burning out, you are not going to achieve them because you'll get to a point where instead of having a conversation with somebody that says, do you mind if we reschedule this? Or can we move the priorities? Or what's most important that we focus on here? You're actually just going to completely not deliver. And so I think you have to have the conversation because if you don't, the other scenario is that you're not going to progress and you might not deliver on expectations anyway.
I think that is such a true thing that everyone has to continue to remember because we can say yes to things that are phenomenal opportunities and then drop the big picture on our happiness. And my publisher asked me to do 2 books in 1 year last year, and I'll tell you, it was the worst decision I ever made. Mm-hmm. I had the most joy writing, but everything else, I'm completely burnt out. So it's a real thing.
Yeah, same. I think sometimes it helps to understand that you have to take a step back to take 2 steps forward, because if you are burnt out, you're not bringing your best self mm-hmm. to that ambitious project you're taking on. I think it's also important to kind of focus less on the finish line of the project and the process, because that's going to help you get to the finish line more efficiently, better. And it's going to help you enjoy it more. So set up a system for achieving that with a reasonable end date that's not going to completely destroy your mental health and burn you out. And then just stick to that process. And don't try to put too much on it to get to it faster, because eventually you're going to get there. That's one thing that that's advice. Like, I'm a hypocrite. I need to take my own advice. Because I try to accomplish things. Like, I want to do X by the time I'm 40. I want to accomplish this by the time I'm 45. And why am I putting those arbitrary numbers on? You have time. So I would also say, don't get so obsessed with trying to rush it. Just learn to enjoy the process.
That's outstanding advice. Okay, we're going to take another question. Can you tell us your name?
Hi. Yeah, my name's Melissa. I'm a researcher of workplace culture, and a lot of the things that you've been talking about really resonate with me. I left an academic job 6 years ago now because I was confused about how to handle a workplace that seemed to be toxic because of the incessant demand for productivity. I've now written a book about that called Counterproductive and how we put pressure on ourselves to be productive as a sign of our success as professionals and as women in particular. And the thing that struck me in a number of the stories here is that the solutions all seem to be very individual. And I now work in a tech company, so I know the role that calendar software, for example, plays in creating that problem of scheduling.
Could you ask the girls a question so they can answer it?
The question is, how do you deal with collective conversations about workload in workplaces that appear to be putting pressure on individuals but are actually putting pressure on everyone?
Wonderful.
That's a great
Leah, I'll toss to you or to one of the girls.
I'll start with some thoughts and then feel free to add in. I think it's a critical question, back to the pickle barrel. There's a number of examples of companies doing things like legislating against email outside of business hours or weekends. I think you can also do that in the micro level, make agreements with your team, because it's like an arms race for the communications. If you set the model as the leader that you're answering your email at 9 p.m., that is showing everybody something that is a very clear message. I think taking vacation time, our statistics are egregious in this country for taking our vacation time. We leave it on the table, or paternity and maternity leave time, right? There's things that I think are critical for us to do as individuals, but also leadership needs to not just have the policies. We are in an area where there's a lot of innovative cultural practices that exist on paper that people don't, if you talk to them and interview them, they don't feel like they can take them, right? So you might have a 6-month leave policy for after having a baby for either parent, but you can't actually take it or you will get a major ding. So I think we need to understand the gap between what our organizations are saying and putting forward as kind of the like spin versus what's actually being implemented, and hold accountable both leadership and asking them questions if they're not modeling it, and trying to do the best that we can to model it ourselves. Those are some initial thoughts.
That's great advice. And we have just time for one more question. I'll let you step up.
All right. I got a pickle barrel question.
Ooh, cool.
So from Pickleland, when you made the comment, Leah, by the way, I'm Leah too. You made the comment about culture. What came to my mind was this: these concentric circles of different cultures,
yes.
Right? And I would love to ask the panel, which culture do you think fed into some of your burnout, and which culture do you think is helping you out of it? And here are the circles I was thinking of.
Let's let the girls answer, because you just answered two great questions. We'll let the panelists answer those first. That way we'll make sure we have time to answer your question.
You guys each want to do a sentence or two?
So the burnout that I experienced, I think the culture that I created, because I was a founder of that company that I worked on, is one, people were working, I think there was some kind of tension around, like, I need to be working because my co-founder is working, and like my other employees are working. And also other thing is that there was no clear purpose of that company. So for Simple Habit, like, I wake up in the morning knowing that we're going to help a lot of people out there. But with that company, it was more like, let's make money on the lock screen. So I think the purpose was also different.
For me, a lot of the burnout comes from this culture of like having to hustle and build your personal brand and have like all, you know, this, these side gigs, and you know, I'm doing a panel on the side gig economy later. So. But I mean, which is I think why it's great of Watermark to do also this panel on burnout, because there's so much pressure now, and our economy is changing where you can't just have one job. You know, like so many people have like five different jobs, portfolio careers, and there's such a pressure to hustle for yourself and get your name out there and do all the things. And I think it's important to scale back and just take stock of, like you were saying, Leah, what's the most important thing? What matters to you the most? You know, where are your core desires?
That's great. We actually do have time for a really brief question if anyone else wants to. You were standing by the mic. You can go ahead, and I'll repeat it if we need to.
Okay, so say you move beyond the guilt and you've been able to take things off your schedule. Have you ever experienced then grief because some of the things that you've dropped were things you really wanted to do but realistically can't? How do you handle that?
Great question. Did everyone hear? Sometimes when you drop commitments to preserve your sanity, sometimes you will regret that or experience grief for something you've dropped. So if that's the case, how do you handle it?
So my first 4 years at Arm, I was responsible for our employee community engagement program. It's called Team Arm, and I absolutely loved it. And in August, I recruited someone to join my team and to work with me on Team Arm. And when I burnt out, the conversations that I was having with my line manager, Oak Health, our employee assistant program was, actually, I need to choose one or the other. I can do diversity and inclusion, or I can do the Team Arm, but I can't do both. And it was like giving up my baby. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happened because of those conversations was also that my colleague ended up working, had a different line manager for a period of time. And I found that quite hard, but also at the same time, just accepting that for me to be adding back value to the organization, I needed that space. I needed to get myself back into a position where I was coping with my workload. I was really excited about work again. But I found it really like, I've got to let this go, because otherwise I'm just not going to be able to cope again. I'm putting myself back into exactly the same situation. And we've already known that it didn't work, right? I couldn't do two jobs, so, yeah.
Good for you for having the courage to do that.
One sentence tactical.
I would love that.
So I started in January. My calendar that I got this year has like a little pocket thing because I'm always losing the little papers for organizing my kids' lives. But I put on the front of that little pocket my no list. And so for me, I'm trying to focus on like travel and being really clear on the implications of travel. So the no list is the things that I'm saying no to, and then I'm attributing to it an amount of time that I'm gaining back in my life. So I agonize. I for sure agonize over the thing I'm saying no to. I want to say yes. I want to go. I want to be there. It's like this amount of time and also the extra work it would be. So give yourself some tactical way to capture that, and I'm very excited at the end of 2019 to look at my no list, and I hope it's really long, and I hope all of yours are too.
Wonderful. Thank you, Leah. Thank you to the entire